Welcome to the Zions Bancorporation second quarter earnings call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require operator assistance during the conference, please press star then zero on your telephone keypad. As a reminder, this call is being recorded. I will now turn the call over to James Abbott, Director of Investor Relations. You may begin.
Thank you very much, Abigail, and good evening. We welcome you to this conference call to discuss our second quarter 2015 earnings. Our primary participants today will be Harris Simmons, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer, Scott McLean, President and Chief Operating Officer, and Paul Burdiss, Chief Financial Officer. I would like to remind you that during this call, we will be making forward-looking statements, although actual results may differ materially. We encourage you to review the disclaimer in the press release and in the slide deck dealing with forward-looking information, which applies equally to statements made in this call. A copy of the full earnings release, as well as a supplemental slide deck, is available at zionsbancorporation.com. We will be referring to the slides during this call. We intend to limit the length of this call to 1 hour, which will include time for you to ask questions. During the Q&A section, we ask you to limit your questions to one primary and one related follow-up question to enable other participants to ask questions. With that, I will turn the time over to Harris Simmons. Harris?
Thank you, James, and welcome to all of you who are participating on the call today. As mentioned, we've published a slide deck for today's call, which we hope will be helpful, especially when reviewing the performance of certain income statement items. Before we begin with the slides, I'd comment that the results of the second quarter of 2015 were generally in line overall with those of the analyst community, somewhat better fee income offsetting somewhat softer net interest income, and lower credit costs offsetting somewhat higher non-interest expenses. If you turn to slide three, we'd simply remind you we made a couple of significant announcements during the second quarter, the most prominent of which regards our efficiency and organizational structure initiative, which I'm confident most of you are familiar with. Most notably, we're reducing the number of bank charters from 7 to 1 and substantially simplifying the back office operations in the company. These changes should result in a better experience for both customers and employees, and they're really focused on making many processes simpler and easier and faster. Once implemented, these changes should ultimately produce both better revenue and expense trajectories. Stronger revenue and holding the line on expenses through 2016 of less than $1.6 billion annually, with only a slight increase of non-interest expense in 2017. We provided and are affirming an efficiency ratio target of less than or equal to 70% in the second half of 2015, less than or equal to 66% in 2016, and in the low 60s in 2017. I've been very encouraged with the employee response to such substantial changes. A survey of a large sample of our employees indicates very strong support for the organizational actions we're taking. Turning to slide four, our other major announcement this quarter was with respect to the sale of the CDO portfolio, the remaining securities in that portfolio. In the most recent Comprehensive Capital Analysis and Review, or CCAR, exercise, our securities portfolio produced a loss of approximately $400 million in the Federal Reserve's severely adverse stress model. While Zions owned other securities besides the CDOs, we had no reason to believe that any of those securities would have triggered any loss, as they consist of a municipal bond portfolio that has produced virtually no losses historically, and securities that are generally backed by government guarantees, such as our Small Business Administration securities, government agency mortgage-backed securities, and cash deposited at the Federal Reserve. Thus, we concluded that the treatment of the CDO portfolio and the Federal Reserve's stress testing models under hypothetical severely adverse economic environments was highly unsatisfactory and was a major catalyst in our decision to sell the balance of the portfolio. As an isolated item, this reduced our risk-weighted assets by $1 billion, or about 2% of the total risk-weighted assets. In contrast, the revenue from such securities was less than $10 million annually, making the return on the Federal Reserve's post-stress equity equal to about 1%, which made the decision to sell fairly easy. I would note that by exercising some patience on these securities over the years, we were able to achieve a price that was several hundred million dollars in excess of the price we would have experienced in 2009. Turning to slide 5 on credit quality, we were pleased to report that credit quality is holding up very well. There's really only one segment of our portfolio that is experiencing any degree of stress, which I'll discuss in a moment. But the overall rate of increase on classified loans was very slight at 1.9%. Non-performing assets declined more than 3% from the prior quarter. Our reserve ratio is quite strong, although not shown relative to peers here on this slide. Zions is one of the strongest in the industry by a number of ways of measuring it. You can see this reflected by the coverage of non-performing assets and net charge-offs at 1.9 times and 15 times, respectively. Our reserve on our energy portfolio did not change relative to the prior quarter. We previously indicated that we'd built a very strong reserve in the fourth quarter of 2014 and first quarter of 2015. And although we transferred some of the qualitative reserve to the quantitative reserve in the second, to the quantitative portion of the reserve, if you will, in the second quarter, as classified energy loans increased moderately, we did not need to increase the energy reserve, which is about 3% of total energy loans. Overall, we expect that loan losses will remain well contained. Even considering the moderate stress in the energy portfolio, we are not expecting a significant deviation from the recent run rate of net charge-offs. Turning to slide 6, I would highlight two items. First, the oil and gas loan portfolio balance has declined to $3.1 billion from $3.4 billion at March 31st, with a proportion of the portfolio remaining relatively stable. Much of this is attributable to the statistics displayed on the right-hand side of the chart. Capital markets and private equity support of these companies has been very strong. We even hear of a number of potential investors receiving substantially less than their desired allocation on some of these recapitalization deals. This activity is obviously very helpful in right-sizing the capital of the energy companies and mitigating credit risk for Zions, but is resulting in a considerable headwind to our overall loan growth, which was the weak spot for us this quarter. As an outlook for energy lending trends, we expect continued loan balance reductions of between $100 and $200 million in the second half of the year, a much slower rate of attrition than we've experienced in the most recent quarter, but still a significant headwind. As we conducted the spring borrowing base redetermination process on energy exploration and production credits, we used a price deck that is reflective of current market prices, which can be seen in the appendix slides of the recent Barclays conference materials. We expect some further downgrades in the energy portfolio as we see second quarter results from the oil field services companies. But as we speak to those companies, they are generally feeling that their second quarter results may be fairly reflective of the foreseeable run rate given the current pricing of oil at between $45 and $55 per barrel. Therefore, the downgrades we are anticipating should be the bulk of what is to come, and we have generally reserved for those downgrades. And so in summary, the deterioration of energy credits is playing out consistently with, and in some cases somewhat better than our outlook in December of 2014 when we first alerted you to the potential implications of the adverse movement of energy prices. With that, I'll turn the call over to Paul to review our financials. Paul?
Thank you, Harris. Turning to slide 7, for the second quarter of 2015, Zions reported a $1.1 million or 1 cent per share loss. Adjusting for the one-time loss related to the sale of collateralized debt obligation securities, earnings per share were 41 cents in the second quarter. Relative to the prior quarter, we experienced an improvement in net interest income, reflecting an additional day in the quarter and in fee income, which I will review shortly in more detail. We also experienced an increase in non-interest expense, although there were a number of items within that result that warrant a more detailed review. The provision for loan and lease losses was slightly positive, a byproduct of the extensive analysis of the appropriate reserve at each of our affiliate banks. If I could, let me direct your attention to the capital ratios at the bottom of this page. You'll notice that the Basel III Common Equity Tier 1 ratio was estimated at 11.91%, and that the prior quarter's ratio is lower than originally reported. This is due to the fact that we have made an adjustment to the risk weighting of some of our construction and land development loans, migrating them to the Basel III category of high volatility commercial real estate, or HVCRE. As described in the press release, a clarifying frequently asked question document was released by the regulators during the quarter, and after our review of that document, we concluded that it would be appropriate to classify a portion of our construction and land development loans into the HVCRE category, which receives a risk weighting of 150%, up from the standard 100% for a non-HVCRE commercial loan. The key issue in this reclassification relates to the loan contract and whether or not it contains a clause that prevents the borrower from withdrawing cash from the deal. For example, as construction progresses, a certificate of occupancy is issued to the building, and the building begins to experience net positive cash flow. However, the building's cash flow is not yet fully sufficient to qualify for permanent financing. Typically, a developer may begin to utilize some of that positive cash flow for other purposes. While the loan-to-value ratio of the loan may remain low and therefore would be substantially stronger than underwriting guidelines. Because the lending contract does not specifically prevent the extraction of some of the cash flow from the deal, our interpretation of the FAQ document has led us to reclassify such loans as HVCRE under the Basel III rules. Turning to slide 8, net interest income rose by about $6 million versus the prior quarter to $424 million, reflecting an additional calendar day in the quarter. This led to a net interest margin of 3.18% in the second quarter, which was down 4 basis points from the prior quarter. Much of this decline was attributable to a shift in the mix of the balance sheet toward cash and investment securities. This shift was driven by the strong inflow of deposits, with average deposits rising by more than $640 million in the quarter. Without commensurate loan growth, due in part to accelerated prepayments, the growth in deposits was largely channeled into lower-yielding deposits at the Federal Reserve and other interest-bearing cash instruments, which increased by more than $400 million from the prior quarter. The chart on slide 9 depicts the reported yield on the loan portfolio, the coupon of the portfolio, which excludes amortizing origination fees, and the coupon on new production. Notably, the green segment shows an increase in the coupon on new production, although much of this is due to a mix shift in production, including an increase in small business loans and a decrease in large corporate deals. Holding deal size and loan grade constant, pricing has generally been stable for the last couple of quarters, which is an encouraging trend. We also note that an increase in short-term interest rates would likely move the yield on Zions loan production to a level which is higher than the overall portfolio, assuming pricing discipline could be maintained. Regarding loan volume, total loan production increased about 5% from the prior quarter. Period-end loan balances, excluding energy-related credits, increased $128 million from the prior quarter. However, due to strong prepayments in energy credits, as mentioned earlier by Harris, as well as elevated levels of prepayments on both residential and commercial mortgages, overall loans declined $156 million from the prior quarter end. Turning to slide 10, reported non-interest income was less than $1 million. However, this slide depicts three adjustments that we believe are informative for assessing the underlying strength of non-interest income. The first bar adds back the sum of all equity and debt securities gains and losses, or about $134 million. The second bar adjusts for the fair value and non-hedged derivative income line item, which is traditionally a volatile number. The third bar adjusts for the gain on the sale of a branch. The net effect of these adjustments is a non-interest income figure of about $130 million. This is a fairly strong increase relative to the prior quarter and was attributable to strength in several areas, including larger commercial deposit account analysis fees, strong growth in bank card, interest rate swaps purchased by our customers, and increased loan servicing income. These positive trends were offset somewhat by declines in insufficient funds fees, which is consistent with recent industry experience. Slide 11 is intentionally titled Informing the Outlook and is not intended to reconcile to a core or operating number for non-interest expense, as some of the expenses outlined here are clearly integral to running the company. Instead, the information on slide 11 is intended to provide transparency on the underlying trend of non-interest expenses. I'll highlight a couple of the bars on this page and then address questions later as needed. First, the seasonal share-based compensation adjustment is the amount of stock that is granted to employees that are immediately eligible for retirement. And as such, these expenses are recognized immediately rather than amortized over a period of years that is typical of stock grants. For Zions, this occurs each year in the second quarter, and we have referenced the seasonal impact in past earnings calls. It is an operating cost but does not generally occur in the other quarters. The next bar to the right represents a cost of certain incentive plans that are affected by stock price. Employees are granted units that generally pay after 3 years if certain long-term goals are accomplished. While these units ultimately pay out in cash, the total payment is tied to share price performance, which is intended to align the interest of these employees to both long-term goals and to the price of Zions stock. With the second quarter's strong share price performance, an additional accrual was warranted for these plans. The last bar I will highlight is the $9 million in insurance recoveries, which were largely related to the legal settlement reached in the fourth quarter of 2014. The result of all of these pluses and minuses is approximately a $400 million non-interest expense figure. While we are still in the early stages of our cost reduction efforts, we expect that costs for the second half of this year will be below $800 million, bringing the overall non-interest expense for 2015 to below $1.6 billion. On slide 12, we outline the efficiency ratio to which we are managing. We believe our definition is consistent with the industry standard and modified slightly to exclude the effect of the provision for unfunded lending commitments, severance, and restructuring items. While our efficiency ratio has been trending favorably over the past several quarters, we will continue to drive performance improvements in order to realize our efficiency ratio objectives, which are below 70% in the second half of 2015, and below 66% in 2016, with continued improvement thereafter. Page 13 depicts our outlook for the next 12 months relative to the most recent quarter. We are maintaining our slightly to moderately increasing outlook for loans. This outlook incorporates changing portfolio composition as the energy industry raises capital and reduces leverage. In the next 6 months, we are expecting loan growth to be on the lower end of that range, accelerating slowly as the size of the energy portfolio stabilizes. We are raising our outlook for net interest income to moderately increasing from slightly increasing, driven primarily by the continued addition of duration in the investment portfolio and from lower interest expense related to the expected reduction of high-cost debt in the second half of this year. Our outlook does not include the effect of any rate increases by the Federal Reserve, although we expect a benefit to annual net interest income of about $150 million for each 100 basis point increase in short-term rates. Of course, we recognize that by extending the duration of the investment portfolio, we are tempering that rate sensitivity somewhat, but we are comfortable that by building our exposure to duration over time and limiting extension risk in the portfolio where possible, we will be able to add to net interest income if rates rise while protecting earnings in an adverse economic environment. We expect that non-interest income will increase moderately as we continue to focus heavily on this key source of revenue. And as stated previously, we are committed to holding non-interest expense to less than $1.6 billion for both 2015 and 2016, excluding severance and restructuring expenses. We have modified our outlook on the provision for loan losses to flat to slightly positive from positive. We've attempted to describe during this call the situation with the energy loan portfolio and the expected credit deterioration there. However, we believe that we've captured the bulk of that migration in the qualitative reserve already. Other segments in the portfolio continue to perform very well, and loss rates remain very low. This concludes our prepared remarks. Abigail, would you please open up the line for questions?
Certainly. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press star and then the number one key on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Our first question comes from the line of Steven Alexopoulos with J.P. Morgan. Your line is open.
Hello, everybody.
Steven. Hi.
Paul, I just wanted to ask you, on the expenses, I think I just got what you said, the $800 million in the second half, are you only excluding severance and restructuring? Because on page 15, you give a whole list of items you're excluding, I guess, to come up with the efficiency ratio. But in terms of the $1.6 billion for the year, are those the only two items you're adjusting for?
Yes, that's correct, Steven.
Okay. And then, no shocker, I have a question on the energy exposure. You guys provide the classified energy loans of $325 million in the quarter. Could you provide what the balance of criticized loans were and how that changed? And just an update of how much of the $3.1 billion in energy are Shared National Credits. Thanks.
So, we mentioned, this is Scott McLean. We mentioned the criticized level on energy in the first quarter call. We don't normally disclose that, but because we did in that call, it's about 20% today. And the for criticized, classified is 11%. And the percentage of Shared National Credits on the reserve-based portfolio is about 80%. On the oilfield services portfolio, it's less than 60%. It's about 55% or less, a little bit less.
Okay, thanks for the color.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Brian Klock with KBW. Your line is open.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi.
So, question for you, Paul. I guess thinking about the Fed's change with CCAR moving to CET1 versus the Tier 1 Common, and thinking about last year's severe adverse scenario, Zions did much better versus on the Tier 1 Common. Obviously, there's a lower threshold than CET1. I guess, should we be thinking about that, I guess, more positively for Zions, I guess, moving to next year's CCAR with the CET1 being the focus?
Well, yeah, so that you're referring, of course, to the notice of proposed rulemaking that came out last Friday. And in fact, when you look at our CCAR results under the severely adverse case, we were at, if you may recall, about 5.1% of Tier 1 Common Equity under the Basel I definition versus a limit of 5%. If that, in fact, goes away for next year, as you correctly point out, we'll be focused on the Basel III definitions, which is a Common Equity Tier 1 measure. And on that basis, in last year's submission, we reported a number of about 6% versus a limit of 4.5%.
Actually, I mean, the Fed reported that, the 5.9.
Sorry. Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Right.
Great. So, in thinking about it, and I guess as a follow-up, if we think about that and what you guys have done to sort of reposition the risk and getting rid of the CDO portfolio, I mean, I guess all things equal, you'd have a CET1 ratio that'd be in the 6% range versus a 4.5% limit in the Fed CCAR process.
But, you know, look, I'll be honest with you, it's sometimes difficult to predict the outcome of the test, but I will say that, you know, we expect our buffer, if you want to call it that, this next coming year under a Basel III basis, would be better than what we experienced under the Basel I basis last year.
Great. Thanks for your time, guys.
Yep.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Ken Zerbe with Morgan Stanley. Your line is open.
Great, thanks. Question on the high volatility CRE loans. Obviously, you know, hits the risk-weighted assets this quarter. Is there anything that you guys can do, on a going forward basis? Like, can you rewrite the contracts when they come due? How quickly are changes actually possible on this, or do you plan to make any changes, to help bring down the risk weighting on those? Thanks.
We'll have Michael Morris, as our Chief Credit Officer, discuss that. Michael?
So, Ken, there are things that we can do contractually with the borrower to preclude internally generated capital, i.e., cash flow, from coming out of a construction project. There are market considerations not to do that, But we can do that to stem the higher risk weight. That's an option. We can also price for those loans differently. So there are several options that we have that we're looking at, and that will be dictated somewhat by the market and somewhat by credit and risk.
Sorry, just to clarify, so is that something you actually plan to do, or should we just kind of assume that the risk weighting stays elevated?
Well, the risk weighting will go down naturally as construction loans pay off and convert to term. And then going forward, we will be putting provisions into the loan language, again, that potentially preclude internally generated cash flow, i.e. debt service, from coming out. But there will be market considerations around that as well.
I think that's just a way of saying, it's going to be a case-by-case assessment we have to make around the value of the relationship, the pricing on the deal, and the what the market is like competitively.
Yeah, I would remind you this is a fairly new sort of FAQ and interpretation, so we are working through the impact on the portfolio, particularly from the perspective of what the market is willing to bear.
Understood. Okay, and then just one follow-up question. On the fee side, I think you have a slide showing the sort of quote core fees was around $130 million, but it did include a lot of sort of good things. Just a lot of line items are a little bit higher. Is 130 kind of a good starting point for next quarter, or is there a little more of a reversion lower as a starting point? Thanks.
Yeah, the purpose of the slide was to try to provide a basis for kind of ongoing expectations. And so the adjustments we've made, we believe, make that number a decent starting point.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Jeffrey Elliott with Autonomous Research. Your line is open.
Oh, hello there. It's Jeff Elliott from Autonomous.
Hi, Jeff.
Hello, Jeff.
Hi. Quick question again on regulation. If there's a decision to raise the $50 billion threshold for inclusion within CCAR to something higher than your current asset size, can you give a sense of what you'd expect the impact of that to be, both in terms of expenses and then in terms of increased flexibility around capital and how you might think about managing your capital structure differently?
Sure. I think obviously the the devil's in the details always with these things, and so it's hard to know exactly what the implications would be until you know what other expectations might be embedded in the language of any statute that replaces the current language. But because I would assume that we will continue in any event, we would expect that we would continue to conduct Dodd-Frank Act stress tests. The cost of that exercise, I expect, would moderate somewhat. The level of detail and the sophistication of the models in terms of continuing to improve them and just the maintenance of the apparatus that we use to conduct those tests would probably moderate in cost. So, but it's hard to know exactly how much. I've noted that we spent about $20 million last year in direct cost on the CCAR stress testing exercise. I don't expect all of that would go away, but I expect that the number would probably moderate significantly. I think the most important outcome in many respects would be just greater clarity around how we manage capital. We'd be managing to our own internal models, presumably. We would not be subject to the vagaries of the Federal Reserve's models, which are, as you know, not particularly transparent. And we believe that that would be a very positive outcome in terms of how we go about thinking about managing capital. But beyond that, we just have to see what happens. I do think there's a fair amount of positive sentiment. You saw last week that Janet Yellen, chairwoman of the Fed, indicated that she would support an increase in the $50 billion threshold. We've seen that from Governor Trullo, from a variety of politicians, and so we're hopeful that that momentum will continue. It would be a very positive outcome for the company.
Thanks. And then a quick follow-up. Given that you've been relatively tight on the CCAR exercise this year and you had the objection last year, how much do you think that kind of feeds into your thinking on potential to be much more ambitious when it comes around to next year and you're submitting a capital ask?
You know, I think it's just premature to speculate on that. We'll want to see how our own internal results from our own stress testing turn out, and it's something we'll need to review with our board. I don't think we have a view on that yet.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Joe Morford with RBC Capital Markets. Your line is open.
Good afternoon, guys.
Hi.
I guess the release mentioned that the results include the findings of the Shared National Credit Exam. You know, did you see many downgrades from that? And coming out of it, you know, roughly how much of your energy reserves are still unallocated or in that kind of qualitative bucket?
Joe, first of all, the on the Shared National Credit Exam, as we indicated, the results are fully, you know, baked into the numbers we presented. And we didn't experience any material changes to what we had internally. And as for the reserve, the last part of your question, I'm not sure. I don't have a specific response to that at the moment.
So there was just a very slight decline in the qualitative reserve, and as that some of that qualitative reserve migrated to the quantitative reserve, it was very, very slight.
Okay, that makes sense.
Particularly to the energy portfolio.
And that's consistent with what we have been saying, was that we would not make any major changes in the qualitative reserve in terms of shifting it to the quantitative. Probably in the first couple of quarters here, we need to see more experience. But it would suggest that the experience through the second quarter was more favorable than we expected. We still believe that we'll see an increase, as we note, in classified assets on the energy side in the third and fourth quarter, and it'll particularly come in energy services. But we've been saying that since last December. We don't anticipate significant increases in reserve-based credits during the third and fourth quarter.
Right.
If that gives you a bit more color.
Yeah, no, that's very helpful. Thanks, Scott. I guess the other question is, just was curious if you could quantify the amount of kind of term CRE paydowns this quarter relative to the first. It sounds like they were elevated. And, you know, given this trend as well as the ongoing decline in the energy book, I mean, where do you expect to see some loan growth?
Yeah, Joe, this is James. The increased CPR speed on the term commercial real estate book increased about 5 percentage points linked quarter. And that's about the same we saw for the residential portfolio as well. So you have to go back several years to find a CPR speed that was comparable to that. So it was an unusual quarter from that perspective.
Okay.
In terms of where loan growth will come from, it's, I mean, we're continuing to push on sort of the usual suspects, which is which would be C&I and consumer, and particularly residential mortgage. Though I would expect that we'll see some growth in CRE, assuming the prepayment speeds don't continue at this pace.
Right. Okay. Thanks, Harris.
Yep.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Jennifer Demba with SunTrust. Your line is open.
I'm sorry, my question was just covered. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Our next question comes from the line of Paul Miller with FBR. Your line is open.
Hey, afternoon. It's actually Thomas Letourneau on behalf of Paul. One quick question, I guess, again, on the prepayments. I'm assuming the loan growth guidance for the next 12 months assumes those moderate. Is there anything as it relates to third quarter that's giving you the confidence that they've slowed down in the near term?
Just too early to know, I think.
Yeah, the outlook that we provided was a 12-month outlook, I would remind you.
Right. Okay, so nothing immediately so far, too early, this early in the quarter. And then one follow-up on the $700,000, I realize it's a small item, on slide 11 for the non-interest expense, the professional services. Is that something that could be in there going forward, or was that just sort of a, because you had this initiative announced in second quarter and that you sold the CDO portfolio, that should be sort of minimized going forward?
It's we're going to have expenses that I would describe as sort of restructuring costs. They may not be business closure type expenses, but there'll be expenses that are necessary to facilitate the charter consolidation, to facilitate the organizational simplification we're trying to bring about. And those kinds of costs we said we were excluding from the $1.6 billion.
Okay, understood. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Dave Rochester with Deutsche Bank. Your line is open.
Hey, good afternoon, guys.
Hi.
Hello.
I just had a question on the margin. On slide 9, I was just wondering how much of the difference between that yellow line for the book yield and the coupon line, that red line there, was accretion income this quarter. And then as you look at the loan pipeline, are you expecting the mix shift to smaller loans that drove that uptick in the loan production coupon rates to persist through the second half?
That probably is accurate because particularly with the softness in energy underwriting, which is totally to be expected, the coupons there are generally lower, and so that you'd have a smaller volume of lower coupon transactions kind of just working into the mix.
As it relates to the amount of accretion in between those, I don't think it's material. James could probably follow up with a precise number, but I don't think that's a material part of what you're seeing there.
Yeah, the only thing I would add is in terms of accretion, these are loan yields, of course, but on the margin, there was a couple of basis points of margin pressure more this quarter than there was last quarter on premium amortization from the MBS prepayment speeds also accelerating.
Great. And then just one quick follow-up. We've heard some banks indicate a little bit more in the way of deposit pricing pressure this quarter. It doesn't look like you've had that from your results, but any color you can share there on what you're seeing in the market would be great.
I think it's still very benign. I mean, we had pretty reasonable deposit growth, and, you know, we're seeing it in non-interest bearing, and so we're just not seeing the need to go out and pay up for money anytime soon.
And as you point out, the total rate we paid on deposits was consistent from quarter to quarter.
Yep.
Great. All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of John Pancari with Evercore ISI. Your line is open.
Good afternoon.
Hi,
Chuck. Good
afternoon. The 30 to 89 day past dues, they're up about $28 million or so linked quarter. What drove that? Was that energy at all, or was that non-energy?
I have
a little color on that.
Yeah, Michael Morris will.
So energy up. Energy was up slightly, but that would be it. There were a couple of term loans, CRE term loans, but that would be the totality of it.
Okay. All right. And secondly, on energy, what percentage are you through the analyzing the oil field service portfolio and getting the financial statements in and everything? Did you give us that?
Yeah, sure. On the oil field services portfolio, we on that entire portfolio, at a minimum, we receive statements on a quarterly basis. And so all of the first quarter numbers are in. I'm going to say all. I would say virtually all. On a number, a large percentage of that portfolio, we also receive numbers on a monthly basis. So I think you can feel comfortable that we've seen all the first quarter numbers, and we'll have all the second quarter numbers by mid-August to late August at the latest. And we expect to see, as we've noted numerous times, deterioration in the second quarter. The numbers didn't deteriorate that much in the first quarter, which we didn't think they would. But we will see deterioration in the second quarter and the third quarter. But I would tell you that the relationships that we were most concerned about since last December on the oil field service side have stayed pretty consistent. And so we're not seeing deterioration beyond what our sensitivity testing led us to believe last December. And in fact, if anything, we're seeing improvements where lines are being reduced much more quickly than we thought. Private equity has come to the fore much more quickly than we thought. And there's just been a tremendous amount of capital that has entered the oil field service space, just as there has been that has entered the reserve-based lending area. So if anything, we've seen more favorable trends than negative trends through two quarters.
Okay. All right. And that's helpful, Scott.
And none of that favorable, by the way, would temper our conservative posture towards what we believe will happen in terms of some additional deterioration between now and the end of the year.
Right. But you still think, though, in terms of the reserve, that you've got the ability to reallocate more likely versus having to add materially to the reserve?
We believe that.
Okay. And then separately, in terms of the energy balances, I know you had indicated about 100 to 200 million in incremental declines that you could see there by the end of 15. So that's in total. That's on a quarterly number. That's in total, right? By the end of 15.
Yes.
Yeah. That's a.
Okay.
Yeah.
In total, the total energy balances ought to be down about 400 million for the entire year.
Right.
It'll be between 400 and 500 million.
Got it. Okay, good. Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Ken Usdin with Jefferies. Your line is open.
Thanks. Good afternoon, everyone. Just a question on your mortgage-backed securities purchase plan. It looks like your average balances were about the same at the period end. So I was just wondering if you can just give us an update on that kind of 2+2+2 outlook and your paces of purchase relative to what's happened in the rate environment.
Yeah, I think if you're looking at the available for sale line on the face of financials, I think what you may be seeing is some of that growth has been masked by the sale of the CDOs. We as discussed previously, we expect to maybe accelerate or decelerate those purchases over time, and as our view of rates changes, I would say, and I think I said here recently that my expectation would be for the next several months at least, and perhaps the next quarter or two, we're going to see perhaps a slightly faster pace of additions to both mortgage-backed securities and swaps than perhaps you would have seen certainly in the first quarter.
And specifically within that, are you biased at this point to do more in MBS versus swaps? Is there a way you can kind of help us understand how that'll look, balance sheet versus just income statement effect from the swaps?
I don't think we're particularly biased one way or the other. I think we are putting a little more into cash than swaps currently, but we don't have I wouldn't say that we've developed a very strong view on one versus the other.
Okay, and then your reinvestment yields, just any color, kind of front book, back book, kind of how you gave us on the loan portfolio?
Well, I'll tell you, in swaps, we're focusing in sort of the 3 to 5 year part of the curve. And on MBS, we're looking at fully amortizing either 5-1 ARMs or 10-year pass-throughs.
Okay, Got it. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Brett Robinson with Piper Jaffray. Your line is open.
Hi. Thanks. Good afternoon. Was just curious, you mentioned earlier new production, and as a follow-up to some questions on loan growth, I guess I'm just curious to think about X-Energy, how you feel about the Texas geography in terms of its potential for some growth, or if you feel like the economy there is just too stifling for that to be kind of a net growth area for you.
Yeah, this is Scott, and we loan demand has softened in Texas, and so they will be up year over year, but it'll be modest there. And you know, if you looked at the end of last year, they were up about, and really the last couple of years, $700 to $800 million each year over year, and that number will probably still be up by the time we get to the end of 2015 year over year, but it'll be a much more modest increase, probably in the $100 to $200 million range.
Okay, and then as a follow-up to that, what's kind of your strongest growth geography at this point in terms of where you guys think you'll get your best opportunity?
We're seeing actually Texas was down for the month, or for the quarter rather, as you might imagine, and Utah actually had some fairly strong growth. All things, it was not a strong growth quarter for the company overall, but Utah experienced about a $35 million increase overall, and that is despite probably about a $120 million reduction in the National Real Estate Group, which has been an ongoing runoff portfolio for several years now. Arizona also has been a strong, consistent growth franchise.
And as Harris noted earlier, I would just say that it's, you know, everybody is very focused on just kind of core C&I growth, core 1-4 family, kind of the private banking piece, professional and executive lending. Those are the three real drivers for us. And the good news is that's, you know, what we've done for many, many years. So it's not a new area to focus on.
Okay, appreciate the color.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Gary Tenner with D.A. Davidson. Your line is open.
Thanks, guys. Actually, Brett just asked my question.
Good.
Our next question comes from the line of Terry McEvoy with Stephens Inc. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. You noted strong fee income growth, looking at both quarter over quarter and year over year. And I'm wondering, any of the changes made in connection to your efficiency initiatives last month, was any of that put in place in Q2? And if not, are you feeling better about some of the growth in some of those businesses going forward?
Right. So the strength we've seen the first 6 months of the year is really coming in our treasury management business, which represents about 30% of our fee income, and it's the business, as you know, where we have national recognition and have for some time. The other real drivers have been mortgage. Our mortgage business is experiencing real nice growth again, and the rest of our credit card business is experiencing nice growth. And then we are seeing customers being much more willing to engage in interest rate hedging than they have over the last 2 or 3 years. So we've seen some real growth there. And so those trends have been evident really for about the last 9 months, as Paul noted, all of which has been offset to a certain degree by the softness in NSF and commercial loan commitment fees. But the institution of one executive in the company, Jake Hughley, to focus entirely on fee income has been a terrific addition. It's raised the constant visibility and dialogue across the whole company about not just driving our core fee businesses, but just looking for other revenue and pricing opportunities. And so I would just say that is new. It is different. We announced it earlier in the year, and it's having a very positive impact.
And then just as a follow-up.
I'd add that the card business continues to be a really good grower for us as well.
And card represents about 20% of our $500 million in fee income.
And then have you discussed publicly your branch strategy, where you see your branch count going? And I saw the small branch gain, obviously, in this last quarter and didn't know if we should expect more branch divestitures, sales, and gains going forward.
We did note in our June 1st announcement that we would be trimming our branch number a bit and over the next 12 months. And I wouldn't describe it as anything other than just normal trimming that you would do. We have about 450 branches, plus or minus, depending on when you measure it. And at any particular time, we're going to be trimming that that collection of branches, as well as introducing new locations as well.
Great. Thanks again.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of John Morin with Macquarie Capital. Your line is open.
Hey, good afternoon, guys.
Hello.
I think, Scott, you mentioned that the energy book was about 20% criticized at the end of the quarter. Could you remind us where that went to at the peak of kind of the last cycle?
Yeah. You know, quite frankly, we really haven't quoted that number that far back. I'd have to sort of criticized level.
My redirect, I was going to say on classifieds, it reached about 20%.
Right.
And that's the number that criticized is pretty very, very broad definition, of course, for what is in criticized. But classifieds, a little bit more refined, and that reached about 20%. And on a comparable basis, we're at 11% today. Our own outlook for it has moderated a little bit from where it was in December. We believe that that number will not reach what we thought it would reach back in December. So things have gone a little better than what we had expected at that point in time.
Okay. And then maybe just a follow-up to a question on Texas sort of broadly. And maybe it's for Michael or Scott, just anything else flashing kind of yellow or red at this point in metrics that you guys are looking at? I know that there's been a lot of concern, particularly in Houston, on multifam and CRE. So any color that you can give us there?
Sure. On the CRE side, obviously we're watching multifamily and office there very closely. Our office construction portfolio is I would describe it as modest in size. And the office term loan portfolios performing well there. And on the multifamily piece, we've had about five, six multifamily transactions that have come out of the construction period, and they're achieving rents that are actually above the pro formas. But we will see softness there as the portfolio continues to mature. And I would say that of our multifamily portfolio, about 40-45% of it is outside of Houston in Texas. And the economy in Houston in general, you know, you're going to see, my guess is, some job growth in Houston this year over year. I mean, it's not going to be the 80 to 100,000 Houston's been averaging the last couple of years. But you'll see 10 to 20,000 in job growth. You'll see housing starts that will approach 30,000, but clearly office vacancies, well, there'll be softness there, and there'll be softness in multifamily. But we think our real estate portfolio is about $1.5 billion less going into this downturn than it was going into the 2009 downturn. And the amount of land A and D was it peaked at $980 million in 2008, 2009. That land A and D portfolio today is about $100 million. So the mix of the portfolio, the size of the portfolio is very different than the 08, 09 experience, and the mix is exceedingly different.
Yeah, Scott, I would only add that our going-in underwriting on a loan-to-cost basis on both multifamily and office of those projects that are under construction still were very strong on the multifamily side, 35 to 40% cash equity. On the office side, 30 to even 50% cash equity. So we've always been very focused on skin in the game from our clients, and both of those asset classes that Scott described have very strong underwriting metrics going in.
Perfect. That's really helpful. Thanks.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Oliver Brassard with BMO Capital Markets. Your line is open.
Oh, hi, all our questions have been answered. Thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Erika Najarian. You're with Bank of America. Your line is open.
Yes, hi. Just one from me. In the $150 million NII sensitivity for a 100 basis point increase in short rates, could you remind us what your deposit volume and beta assumptions are in that $150 million and how that compares the last time we saw the short end of the curve rise?
Erica, pardon me, this is Paul. I think we provide some pretty good and transparent disclosures in our 10-Q. And in there, you can see our estimates around what we are assuming are the duration of deposits. So implied in that is a significant repricing, for example, of zero interest-bearing demand deposits into interest-bearing sources. So we haven't provided any specific guidance as it relates or disclosure as it relates to betas. I would say that our beta assumptions are generally consistent with what others have disclosed, and I would direct you to our disclosures in the queue, which I think are pretty good and transparent as it relates to the assumed duration of our deposits, given the fact that we've got so much of our deposits in zero interest-bearing demand.
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of David Eads with UBS. Your line is open.
Hello. Just maybe one quick one on energy. Wanted to get a sense for how you guys do the price deck and in the redetermination, just thinking about whether there's a difference, whether there would have been a different result with energy, with oil prices now down at $50 as compared to where the, you know, the closer to 60 where they were at the end of the quarter, and how that you know, kind of gets integrated into your methodology.
Right. Good question. And we basically, our price deck is for oil is around $50 right now, and we did not rate. And it has a term aspect to it, but it may go from like $50 to $54 over a term period. But when oil prices went up to $60, we didn't change it, and we generally try to keep our oil price deck at about 90% of NYMEX. And so we certainly could have changed it, but we wanted to see a little bit longer period of strengthening, and I'm glad we did, because quite frankly, we've experienced some softness here in the last 30 days. So, but back when that redetermination started, which was in April, that's really the price deck, and we apply it to the entire redetermination process. We wouldn't switch it in the middle of the redetermination cycle.
David, that price deck is displayed on slide 29 at the Barclays Investor Conference slide deck, which is posted to our website if you're interested.
Great. Thanks.
I'm showing no further questions at this time. I'd like to turn the call back to management for further remarks.
Perfect timing. Thank you very much, everyone, for joining. We're ending right on the hour, so we appreciate your time this evening, and we'll be available for follow-up questions if there are any. Otherwise, we'll see you at a conference or at the next earnings call. Thank you very much for your time and attention today.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for participating in today's conference. This does conclude the program. You may all disconnect. Everyone have a great evening.